In 1942, when Emiko Omori was just 1.5 years old, her family was sent to an internment camp, and it was for Japanese Americans, where they spent the remainder of their war years. Emiko grew up to become a pioneer news camerawoman and a documentary filmmaker, and her film Rabbit in the Moon, which looked at her family's experiences in those camps, won an Emmy when it was shown on PBS in 1999. Now it's being included in a retrospective of her films at Doc Fortnight 2017, an international festival of nonfiction film at MoMA. It's running from this the 16th, which is... Well, now, right?
Yes, it's going on right now.
Through the 26th, and I'm very pleased to welcome Emiko Omori to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having
me. Now, you were just a baby when your family was sent to the camp. Where did they live before they were, before the war?
We lived in a town called Oceanside, or near Oceanside, a small farm community in northern San Diego County in California.
And where were you sent?
We were sent to Poston, Arizona, which is on an Indian reservation in Arizona.
And you point out in the film that people were forced to sell everything they had, whether it was a farm or, in some cases, stores. There's a terrible story about somebody being forced to sell his store for $1,500. And after the war, he finds out that during the war, that store changed hands again for $100,000.
Well, we did not own our farm because a lot of Japanese or Asian immigrants were not allowed to become citizens, and then you couldn't own property not being a citizen. So we didn't own our farm. But yes, we were forced to sell the farm implements and, you know, whatever household things. Everyone was. It was a pretty horrible time.
Well, this brings up the whole matter of the different terms for Japanese in America, the ones born in Japan or America, the ones who stayed here, were born here and stayed here, the ones that were born here and went to Japan for education, that came back, the
yes.
ones who came as immigrants. And they are Issei, Nisei, and Kibei.
Yes.
Your family was Kibei?
Well, our father was born in Japan, therefore he's an Issei. Uh-huh. Our mother was American-born, but went to Japan to be educated. So she's a Kibei, or you could say a Nisei. We, the children, two sisters and I, we were all born here. So we're Americans or Nisei.
And each of the people interviewed in the film is identified as Issei, Kibei, or Nisei. And that was important for viewers to see, to understand their specific situation?
Well, yes, because, the term internment, which is often used, is really only for aliens, enemy aliens. And so we like to clarify that we were not enemy aliens. We were citizens. And so the terms... And within our own society, I don't know, the Japanese are very specific about these kinds of things, you know. So that's one of the reasons that we like to keep it clear that we were American citizens, not aliens that had been taken to the camps.
So you use several different terms for the camps. Internment camps.
Yes.
Relocation centers. Concentration camps. Now, concentration camps is the one you prefer. It's the one that probably is the most loaded because of the German concentration camps.
Absolutely. But the government used that term.
And there were concentration camps in France when people were escaping from Franco, Spain. They were put into what the French called concentration camps before the Germans ever set up theirs.
Well, it is, again, a very specific term about taking people, without due process and being put into prisons, basically, So that's why, yes, but it's difficult to use that term now because of what it means.
So internment camp, sounds a lot better than the concentration camps in Germany.
Right.
Now, you made this film in the 1990s, a half a century after these events took place. And many of the people were already kind of old.
Yes.
You could not make this film today.
Well, many of the people in the film are gone. And we're kind of the very end of the, in what I call eyewitnesses, the people who were there, my sister and I, and people who were born in camp.
And you interview your older sister, Chizuko, for the film. She also served as a producer?
She did.
How old was she when your family was sent to the camp?
12.
And I'm assuming her memories were a lot clearer than yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just 1.5. So, and I made a point in the documentary Rabbit in the Moon that all the people that were in the film itself were there or had something to do with it. For instance, Ernest Bessig, he was the Northern California executive director of the ACLU. I mean, he wasn't in the camps, but he did come to see what was going on and then went on to work with Fred Korematsu to take Fred Korematsu's case up to the Supreme Court.
Now, you mentioned the title of the film again, Rabbit in the Moon. It's not what I would have expected to be the title of a film about people in internment camps or concentration camps.
Well, it's a metaphor for me about being an American. I can see both a man in the moon and a rabbit in the moon. I made a second film very recently, which is also part of the retrospective.
It's like a music video, almost.
Well, kind of a music video, yeah, that's what it is, where I call it When Rabbit Left the Moon, because I feel that the camps did, we lost some of our identity there in the camps, because it was just not good to be American Japanese when we came out of the camp.
So in the Japanese culture, people don't see the man in the moon, they see the rabbit in the moon. Is this typical of Asia in general?
Well, I'm not sure about all of Asia, but yes, many Asian countries see a rabbit in the moon.
I'll have to start looking for the rabbit next time. You include a lot of footage of life in the camps. Were they home movies made by residents?
Yes.
How much of it was the government making official films?
Well, the pre-war footage is home movies made by, the people who were living in the community there. And it was so important when that became available. I mean, they were pretty much unavailable until the Japanese American National Museum put together a compilation of that footage, and it was so important to see what life was like before camp to realize what we had lost.
And you were able to access all of that archival footage?
Yes, they are very generous in letting us use that.
And I'm assuming that most of the people you interviewed were very happy to participate because they had stories to tell.
Well, what Rabbit did, which was different from other documentaries that had been being made at that time, was we brought some issues to the public that were not known. One was resistance in the camps, and in particular, draft resistance. And so these people were not, a lot of draft resistors did not want to speak out, but these people were willing to speak out.
And then also there's the whole issue of the Japanese American Citizens League and the fight over that within the camps.
Yes, and that was something we learned, my sister and I, when we were making the documentary, because they opposed any sort of resistance. And so whenever we talked to people who resisted in any way, for instance, like the draft resistors, Japanese American Citizens League, or JACL, kept coming up about how the JACL was in opposition to any sort of resistance within the camp or against the camps.
They were seen as people who were collaborating with the U.S. government.
Yes, and it has caused a big split in our community that still exists.
Because people remember, they hold grudges?
Well, that's probably true, but because JACL is still really the only big organization within our community.
People were asked to sign loyalty questionnaires.
Yes.
Did everyone in the camps have to fill them out?
It was everybody over, I do believe, 17 years of age. And so, like, my sisters, who I have two sisters, older sisters, you know, we were, and certainly me, we were all too young. But anyone, you know, 17 years and older had to sign a loyalty questionnaire.
And what kinds of questions were asked?
Well, you know, at the beginning, when if you start reading the beginning of it, it sounds sort of like a very benign, you know, sorts of questions. But we found out that these questions were being graded. So let's say you spoke Japanese. Well, that was held against you. Or you belong to the Shinto religion, where if you were Christian, then you got plus points. There were two very problematic questions, questions 27 and 28. And one was to join the military and fight for the United States. And the other one was to forswear allegiance to the Emperor of Japan. And that was problematic because our parents, or my father, was a citizen of Japan, and if he said he would be stateless. And if we were Americans who answered yes to being supportive of the Emperor of Japan, well, first of all, most of us had never sworn support anyway, and so it was like, how could we say, you know, yes or no to that? And if we did say we were going to support the Emperor of Japan, then the American children would be stateless.
How did your parents feel about the questionnaire? Did they talk to you about it at any point? You were too young at this point, but and your mother died before you really had an opportunity to go over these kinds of things. But was this something that was discussed later?
Well, our family was quite typical in that they didn't talk about it. It was kind of like, let's move on, you know, get on with life. But our family, and like others, were pretty discouraged about living in the United States. So our father applied for repatriation. And
that had to score points against him as well.
Yes. And for some odd reason, we were not taken to the Tule Lake Segregation Center, which was where they took what they called the troublemakers. And because those two questions, if you answered no and no, that made you automatically a disloyal person. So we have this term, like the no-no mm-hmm. people or the no-no boys. And there were many contradictions, and one of them is one of the characters in our movie. He was of draft age. And so when the military came to draft people out of the camps, he did answer yes to those two questions, that yes, he would be willing to join the military and forswear, you know, allegiance to the Emperor of Japan. But he put a little caveat, you know, he would join the military if he would be given his freedom and his family to be taken out of these camps. Well, he was kind of automatically seen as sort of a disloyal person for giving that caveat.
We can understand why some people might have been upset to be asked to fight for the United States after they've been put in an internment camp.
Yes.
You point out that German Americans and Italian Americans weren't put in camps or asked to fill out loyalty questionnaires, even though many of them had families in Germany or Italy, and a fair number probably were still citizens of their homelands.
Yes.
Why do you think they were treated differently?
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, it came down to racism.
Are you seeing something like that today? Are you?
Absolutely. And, you know, yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the signing of the Executive Order 9066 that paved the way for us to be taken to the camps. But some Germans and some Italians were also taken to the camps. They were rounded up. But most of them had hearings, and so they were not rounded up en masse, like their whole community. And it happened in Canada. And the United States also asked for some Latin American countries to send up people of Japanese ancestry, Peru being the country that sent the most people up. And the Aleuts up in the Aleutian Islands were also taken off to really deplorable camp situations because actually the Japanese were up in the Aleuts.
Now, we have very little time left, but yeah. I want to talk a bit about your career. You grew up to become a camerawoman at KQED in San Francisco, one of the first women on that job?
Yes.
And when did you start making your own documentary films?
Well, I can't really remember exactly when I started making my own documentary films, but I was working, you know, as a camera person starting in 1968 on KQED, the public PBS station in San Francisco.
Some of the other films in this series you have links to. One of them is to Chris Marker, An Unsent Letter. Chris Marker, the great European documentary filmmaker. Marker, I guess it is.
Yes.
Were you influenced by his work?
Oh, absolutely. And we had a correspondence, and he very much influenced my work. He is kind of always sitting on my shoulder when I'm working on these things, and he allowed me to use a quote at the end of Rabbit.
I'm proud of the fact that I'm the voice on one of the English language versions of one of his documentaries.
Oh, really?
About Wales.
You
also, another film is Ed Hardy, Tattoo the World.
Yes.
And he actually tattooed you?
He did. We met in the mid-70s, and he was at that time bringing this Japanese-style full-body tattoo, kind of introducing it to the West. And so I got a full-body back tattoo from him. And he will be at the screenings, at the screening of his film at MoMA.
And when is that?
Oh, dear.
Well, we have the series running. We'll put the full schedule on our...
It's tomorrow. It's at 7 o'clock.
And we have a link to the full schedule on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. I should throw out one more, because it relates to things that are going on in the United States right now, Passion and Power, the Technology of Orgasm, where Texas, in this case, tried to regulate people's sexuality.
Yes. And that will be screening Wednesday night, and people should come to that because, well, first of all, it's a delightful film, and it's based on a book by Rachel Maines, Dr. Rachel Maines. She will be there, as well as Betty Dodson, who is a very early pioneer in, women's sexuality. And
she's an artist.
Yes, and may I just make a plug for the Doc Fortnite, to do... it's going on now, and it was the guest curator, Kathy Brew, who brought me to MoMA, and I thank her and MoMA.
And you can check it all out at MoMA or on our website at wmyc.org. And Miko Amori, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.